VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
I don't know, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Thank you for downloading and choosing to spend your digital time with us. We know you have lots of options and we truly appreciate it. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I'm excited because in the studio this week, we're joined by Alison Rudd, Rory K. Smith, and down the line from Germany, it's Mr. Matt Hughes.
Collar off to take the corner. Here's De Michelis, it's gone in! And Manchester City are level, and Arsenal are looking at a third consecutive draw in the Premier League.
Arsenal and Manchester City, the champions versus the Gooners. Alison, I read a report in reference to the Rainbow Laces that Arsenal were, quote, chasing rainbows. Do you know what that means?
Well, I think someone's trying to be clever. I assume they mean Arsenal look good enough to maybe be finding the pot of gold one day and winning something.
Is it the same as chasing waterfalls as commemorated by TLC?
Apologies for Rory.
Yeah, no, they're wearing rainbow laces and okay, sometimes the pun comes before what it might mean. And the question is, did Arsenal, who had a reputation last season for failing miserably against the bigger clubs, did they show enough grit, determination, class to do better this season? And there were some good signs, yeah.
Okay, why don't we ask the person who actually wrote it, because he's with us.
Matt Hughes wrote that line.
That's right, Matt. That was you, wasn't it?
I fear it may have been, yeah. Pretty impossible. It's trying to achieve the impossible, isn't it? I think Arsenal, trying to play the way they do and win big trophies is impossible, as we've seen for, well, since 2004. And although they did look encouraging in aspects going forward on Saturday, they showed all the familiar failings at the bat, and particularly given their defensive crisis, I cannot see them being better than third, which is probably fine for the owners and fine for their business model, but it probably isn't going to make the fans happy.
Well, you were there. What would you make of Danny Welbeck? This was, of course, his debut.
I thought he played quite well. He brought something different. He's a lot better than certainly. He's a different and have some more useful option than Olivier Giroud, because his movement is better and he's quicker. He missed the one great chance that came his way, which is a oft made criticism of him, that he's a bit profligate. So I think he showed good and bad. He showed why Arsenal signed him, but also why Manchester United have let him go.
Rory, speaking of Welbeck, in a game like this, up against Vincent Kompany and Martí De Michelis, I thought, wow, Welbeck's actually probably a better matchup from an Arsenal perspective than Olivier Giroud.
They do different things, don't they?
Well, that's why.
I think Kompany's a little bit susceptible to pace. He gets turned quite easily, Kompany. There's something...
Unlike De Michelis, Bobby Moore and Thiago Silva rolled into one.
Come on to De Michelis. I think Kompany's not quite... He's brilliant at times, but he's not quite the defender his reputation suggests he is, Kompany. De Michelis, I can't think of a player who has transformed his image more than De Michelis, and not just because of his haircut. I think there was a time when Demichelis was seen as the weak link. I think he's crucial. He's keeping Mandala out of the team. He's a perfectly good defender, Martin Demichelis. I think Britain owes him an apology.
It's good for Pellegrini, though, isn't it? Because everyone was saying, can he not see it? Is it his blind spot? Look, we can all see it. He can't see it. And he did see the right.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We should all apologise to I think you particularly, Dan, should apologise to Martin Demichelis. No, I think Welbeck, I still think we'll see two Arsenals when Giroud's fit. I think you'll see an Arsenal that's more built to keep possession and play off Giroud, and an Arsenal that's more built to counter-attack with either Sanchez or Welbeck up front. I think there'll be two distinct approaches depending on opponents and depending on the games, which is the one thing that Arsenal really haven't had for quite a long time, is an ability to change the way they play. And I think that's an encouraging thing. There is this profligacy about Welbeck. He hit the post near the bar.
He hit the post, yeah.
Which isn't, you know, is that a miss? I think Hughes has been a bit harsh. I mean, I realise it didn't go in, but it's still, you know, it's hitting the post.
Steve Wilson on Match of the Day thought it had gone in. That's how good it was as a miss.
You mentioned Alexis Sanchez there, and when he's good, he's one of my favourite players, even though he has a girl's name. Alison, I thought he was tremendous. And I think while on the surface, people, you know, looked at it and said, well, you know, he's a little bit like all those other Arsenal players, like little nippy guy. But actually, I think he's really well suited to the Premier League. Were you as impressed with him as I was?
Yeah, but mainly because I was so unimpressed with his first few outings, where he was so busy scampering around trying to look classy that he didn't go anywhere. He was sometimes just running in circles, and I don't know. I just felt, ooh, that's a bit disappointing. But then, what he was doing, presumably, was just getting to grips with the pace of the game here. And I think this was the match in which he showed, okay, I get it now. I've acclimatised now. I can do it. And all the things that were slightly irritating about him in his first few matches were not.
Maybe this is where he fulfils the potential and reaches the levels that, you know, were sort of pushed upon him when he was at Udinese, when people thought that he would become one of the best players in the world.
Well, it's not like he did badly at Barcelona.
No,
I'm not. Everyone's overshadowed by Messi to an extent, Neymar. But yeah, I mean, I think there's no question he's an extremely good footballer, and he could well become one of the sort of top five in the Premier League.
Can you count five Premier League players who are better than him right now?
Fabregas.
I didn't actually name them. I said, can you count to five?
Probably get some, five-ish. Not necessarily better than him, but in the same sort of class.
All right, another guy who I'm more interested in than Alexis Sanchez, Captain Jack Wilshere. Now, I thought, looking back, I thought he was good against England, and I thought this was one of his better performances in an Arsenal shirt, albeit in a different position. Hughes, are you ready to say that he's turned the corner?
Certainly showed encouraging signs. The most encouraging is that he actually scored a goal, which for Jack Wilshere is fairly rare. It's only his 11th goal in five seasons in and around the Arsenal first team, which for ostensibly an attacking midfield player is pretty extraordinary, really. And it cuts to the heart of the dilemma that Hodgson and him and Wenger are facing, really, which is where to play. And Wenger wants to play him further forward. Roy Hodgson, through force of circumstance and lack of options, wants to play him deeper. And it's going to be very interesting to see if he can cope with doing two different jobs. He's saying all the right things, and if he's going to get an England team, he's probably going to have to play deeper, so he will do his best. But it's going to be pretty difficult for him to sort of manage his mind and body through two different roles.
Now, on the flip side, much as I love Frank Lampard Jr., I thought he had a really poor game. Now, obviously, he's filling Yaya Toure's big shoes, and those are very big shoes belonging to a very big man. Was that part of the problem for City, the reason why maybe they didn't get going as easily as they could have? Or do you look at it the other way and say, you know what, all your moaning and complaining, we had two penalty shouts and we hit the woodwork twice, we could have easily scored six?
I thought City played well, and they finished the game really strongly, and I like most people, I suppose thought they were going to win it, and probably should have, given the amount of energy they had at the end of the game, which when you're away from home and you're juggling your difficult European group, that bodes really well that they really went for it at the end there. Lampard, I just think he spent, what was it, 11 years at Chelsea? But I mean, to spend that long at one club and then expect him to just slot into a club which has it's different in so many ways, it just is, to slot in and, as you say, to somehow replicate what Yaya does, he's not even going to do that. I just think It seems odd to say it because he's a really intelligent bloke, but I think he was slightly overawed by it rather than just suddenly having gone completely off the ball.
I think that's a little bit harsh to speak up for Frank Lampard for a second. I doubt he was overawed, but he did look like a 36-year-old who's barely played since May. He wasn't good, but he looked lacking fitness as much as anything else, and it would be hard. It would be, I think, a bit premature to dismiss his.
But you can be, you can, but Matt, you can be on the decline at the club that you know really well because you know how it ticks. It's hard to join a new club, the champions, and you know, and then be able to work out how you balance your age and how you know, Frank Lampard was very good. He lasted so long because he times everything so well. He knows when to emit those bursts of energy.
I guess, but I wouldn't have thought he'd have felt particularly nervous. Gareth's won Premier League titles, European Cups, and
no, not nerves. You know, 80, just 80, 80, 90 it's not nervousness particularly. It's just an inability to do what you do best somewhere new.
All right, enough Lampard. Sorry, you hate him, Alison.
I don't hate him.
I want to ask you about this, Rory, because you're more of a Hispanophile than the rest of us. Manuel Pellegrini complained about the referee. Now, last season, I remember him doing it once and then feeling horrible and contrite about it and apologizing a few days later. Did he get a little carried away here? Because he did have a point with the handball and the, I guess, was it Aguero or Silva who was being fouled?
Aguero.
But by the same token, I mean, we've seen, it's the Premier League, we've seen far worse. I mean, this is the land of Moss and Clattenburg and whatnot.
He did it twice last season, didn't he? There was one in the Champions League, one in, and then after Anfield.
Okay, it was twice. Anfield.
No.
It doesn't happen very often.
You're referring to the one at Anfield? Or the one after the Champions League?
I was referring to the Champions League one.
Yeah. He also criticised Clattenburg after Anfield, so you wonder whether he maybe feels put upon by Mark Clattenburg. I thought probably the most legitimate complaint was for Arsenal's second goal. There was a push on that prevented Kompany getting to the ball. That was a free kick. No question about that in my mind. I don't like it when managers criticise referees. I think it's lazy. And I think that we would do everybody a favour if we didn't report it and didn't talk about it.
Really? Yeah. You think we should just put up with injustice?
No, I think if it's really flagrant, then maybe. But the fact is that it just becomes a default stance for managers after games right. That haven't quite gone their way.
But it's okay for the media to criticise referees, right?
No, I mean, I try and avoid it as much as possible. I think there's too much focus on referees.
Are we allowed to criticise players? Can we have opinions?
Yeah, of course. But again, if referees make really flagrant mistakes, then fine. But if it's a kind of 50-50 judgment call type thing, I don't think it helps. I don't think it creates a positive environment around the game to constantly kind of buy into this managerial agenda of, oh, it's the referee's fault. That game on Saturday was a draw. That was a fair result. Both teams deserved it. City probably could have nicked it at the end. But there's no point. What benefit does it give to anybody to sort of create this climate whereby Clattenburg, when he next referees Man City, might have other things that Pellegrini's criticism at the back of his mind. It's not in anybody's interest.
Okay, so the reason people do this, and it is entirely in their interest, and Pellegrini doesn't do it very often, and I don't think this is what he's doing.
But
the reason you do this is to plant a seed of doubt in the referee's mind and to get a psychological edge.
Yeah, that's not.
And I think we know who does it, and they've been doing it for years.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So when you say, what's the point? That's the point.
No, that's the point.
To serve your team and help your team the next time you have their referee.
That's the point for them. I'm not sure it's in our interest as observers and fans of the game to buy into it.
To give their complaints about officials a poor man. That's fair enough. I can see that.
Yeah, exactly. So in terms of these individual criticisms, yeah, I think Pellegrini probably had a point. But there's something slightly distasteful about him kind of airing his dirty linen like this.
Juicy, you're in Germany right now because you're doing a travelogue on Dortmund and the Ruhr region. No, you're not. But wonderful and warmed by the local passionate fans. Obviously, Arsenal play Borussia Dortmund in the Champions League. Do you get the sense, looking at this, despite the fact that, you know, with Arsenal, you have usual questions with Borussia Dortmund, you've got, you know, no more Lewandowski, you've got a level of uncertainty now, and Gundogan, of course, still out, that these two teams feel like they're ultimately going to walk their groups?
Well, they should both be pretty confident of qualifying, yeah. Anderlecht and Galatasaray, not the strongest opponents. But as you say, both teams are sort of in a little bit of a sort of state of transition. Arsenal trying to rebuild, Dortmund clipping of injuries and, you know, lots of key players since they won since they got to the Champions League final last year. So they're probably not as strong as they would like to be. It's still a test for Arsenal, particularly the the defence. Chambers will have to play at right back because Debussy's injured. Presume Monreal stays at left back with Gibbs coming back. Koscielny's nursing his Achilles problem. So, you know, they're one in defence injury from serious, serious problems. So it'll be an interesting night for him. And it'll certainly be noisy as it always is in Dortmund.
I'm not sure Galatasaray, managed by Cesare Prandelli, would be the idea. I take Hughes's point, and I think Arsenal and Dortmund probably will qualify, but Galatasaray aren't an easy team to have to face. Certainly in Istanbul, they're capable of taking points off both of those teams in Istanbul.
And Arsenal go there in the last game, so they'll want to get it sort of sewn up before then, I would suggest.
Especially because Arsenal have seen in recent years quite how much damage can be done by finishing second rather than first. But the weird thing with Dortmund and Arsenal is that they must be so familiar to each other. I know that they've both had bits and bobs of change, but is it, what, the third time in 4 years they've played each other? There was something very sort of disappointingly familiar about the Champions League draw this year for the groups.
I'm really excited now, Rory.
Yeah, I can tell. Well, that's what I'm trying to do, Hughes.
Fired me up.
I think that's something we're going to have to wrap our heads around because, you know, we're used to the idea of Liverpool playing Everton every year, or twice a year, actually, sometimes even more.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that we need to have sort of major change or whatever. Don't turn everything into an argument, Gab. It's slightly disappointing that it happened in so many groups, or three or four groups this year, that you have teams who have played each other relatively recently. Well, that is nice when teams appear in different combinations in Europe.
City, Bayern, and CSKA Moscow, of course, were all in the same group last year too. But, of course, instead of Victoria Pilsen, they get to enjoy the delights of Roma.
Westwood with the corner. Senderos rising. Agbon Lahore! And on a ground where they have such a fine record, Aston Villa lead once again. Shocking defending from Liverpool. They failed to react to Senderos's header. And it's 2-2 games for Gabby Agbon Lahore.
All right, moving on from that to Anfield, Liverpool and Aston Villa. Rory, you knew this was coming up, so I'll get this out of the way. A few years ago, and you still get hate for this because people assume that if you say something once, your opinion will never change. You suggested that Paul Lambert was a better coach than Brendan Rodgers, or was better at the time in a very specific thing, and you're going to have all your caveats. But, you know, that's not how social media works.
It's not a caveat. It's what I said. I said that there was a time when it appeared to me that Paul Lambert was better at making changes in a game than Rodgers. That over the last couple of years has changed, partly through their circumstances. What I will say, Rodgers obviously has kicked on massively in a way that Lambert hasn't. It's important to note that doesn't mean I was wrong. It just means that things changed. This victory for Villa wasn't anything about that. It was about the fact that Lambert got his tactics spot on. And there is something about the
is
way.
Is that because he's better than Rodgers?
No, it's just.
I was like, I'll give you a chance to gloat.
Funnily enough, There was another game this weekend that kind of reminded me of this. That was Napoli losing to Chievo in Italy. Now, Napoli lost that game to Chievo last year as well, in similar circumstances where they battered Chievo. I think they had 33 shots on goal.
Yeah, not this year, they didn't.
Chievo obviously have a way of setting up against Napoli. It just you get this. You get teams that suit playing other teams. And I think it's true with Villa and Liverpool, that Villa, their strengths obviously kind of maximise and serve to make appear Liverpool's weaknesses, and they've done this several. I think they've not lost at Anfield since 2010, so that's three visits from Lambert without defeat at Anfield with Aston Villa. He knows how to set his teams up at Anfield against Liverpool, and
even against different managers, different players, different systems.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I buy that, but Alisson, right. Was it maybe simpler, the fact that a defensive screw up early on, the visitors take the lead, it allows them to sit back, you have the threat of Wijnman and Agbon Lahore on the break, Sturridge is supposedly injured, Sterling is supposedly being rested, you've got three dudes up front who hadn't played together very much at all in Lallana, Balotelli and Markovic, and Liverpool couldn't score and couldn't even create many chances.
Well, I'd rewind and say I would give credit to Lambert, and there is, my sources in the Midlands say that Lambert has always been annoyed by how Rodgers has had all this praise as being a very, very astute coach tactically, whereas Lambert feels he's just as astute, but he just never had the resources that Rodgers had, and therefore never gets the publicity.
But Rodgers also has better hair and better teeth, Alison.
Undoubtedly.
He's also capable of stringing a sentence together that's of interest to the general public.
Ooh!
Oh, well, if Paul Lambert wants better publicity, he should say things more interesting.
He doesn't want that sort of publicity. He just wants people to say, wow, what a great tactical coach. He just wants them to say anything else.
But
I think he's inspired. And when he meets Liverpool, I think he's... And this happens a lot. There are certain managers who lift their own game against clubs where they feel there's an imbalance in perception.
This was new to me. I thought the whole Lambert-Rodgers thing was just some Rory thing. But instead, there is a genuine sort of edge there to the two of them.
I don't know if Rory started it or not. But
no, I absolutely did not start some sort of feud between Lambert and Rodgers. Liverpool's great success last season was that they were a very settled side. It's the same thing that we might see from Man United this season. Rodgers obviously had one eye on the Champions League, his easiest Champions League game at home to Ludogorets.
He was saving Sterling and from Ludogorets.
No, but I think that he was minded to change the team a little bit to keep Leeds fresh. This is a relatively new challenge for Rodgers, trying to do well in two competitions at once, and it is very draining. And I suspect that against a team like Villa, who are well set up by a manager who apparently wants to beat Rodgers at all costs, it maybe wasn't the time to put Markovic, Lallana and Balotelli all on at the same time, and I think the fact that he brought Sterling on at half time suggests that he recognised that.
Usually these people want to talk about Liverpool. I'd much rather talk to you about Aston Villa. Tom Cleverley, I was excited when he signed. I thought the level of vitriol he faced was kind of way over the top, and I think on top of that, you know why, it's United and whatever else, but could we be looking back and saying, ooh, this might have been one of the best bits of business on deadline day?
Well, it certainly wasn't cheap business.
Well, no, please tell us what you know about the fee, because
he's more the wages. I think he's about 80 grand a week, which for Aston Villa is a lot of money.
Did he get a bump? Or was that his United contract?
That was his United contract.
who signed that contract?
I think the problem with Tom Cleverley has been determining where best to use him. He's clearly has talent and ability. He's very good at doing everything fairly well. He seems to lack a sort of exceptional quality that makes him stand out. But if you have a manager who was prepared to back him and use him in a specific way and, you know, give him clear instructions, he may thrive. United, he was never going to get that because he was kind of bits and places player who was used to cover up deficiencies in the squad elsewhere. Lambert knows how he's going to use him, then he could clearly be an asset for them.
Cleverley, Delph, Westwood. That seems pretty reasonable to me in midfield, no?
Yeah, no, they look like a decent side, but as I say, I'm really surprised by how well they've started. I'm surprised that Roy Keane and Paul Lambert appear to be working well together. I don't know how long it'll last, but they do seem to have, for want of a better phrase, rubbed off on each other quite well. The problem with Villa for a long time was that they seemed to be willfully ignoring a lot of the higher paid players in their squad because they wanted rid of them. Lambert's kind of back down now, whether that's out of necessity, out of his own, because he's been told he's allowed to or whatever, I don't know, but they do seem to have a bit more depth about them. They've started very well. They look defensively very solid despite not having particularly good defenders. Nathan Baker and Philippe Senderos are not Franco Baresi and Alessandro Costacurta by any stretch of the imagination, although I think Baresi...
No, he could have said Alan Hansen and Mark Lawrenson, but no, he's got to go choose your time.
Want someone better. Baresi and Costacurta now are probably technically better footballers than Nathan Baker and Philippe Senderos. They're getting the most from their resource and they deserve a huge amount of credit.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, you looked at that and you...
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So this is where Villa come apart, surely, because Ron Vlaar, most people's World Cup 11, he's missing too. Come on, you know, Liverpool have come up by... nth degree, they're not going to be able to do it again at Anfield, and they did.
Okay, we've only mentioned Balotelli in passing, but obviously I'm contractually obliged to talk about him for ages. But I'll do it in a certain context here. I was struck by this because I saw it when Chelsea played Everton with Diego Costa and Seamus Coleman. And I saw it again with Philippe Senderos on Mario Balotelli. They said, yeah, I'm watching TV, and I hear these ex-pros talking about how clever Senderos is, who's getting inside Balotelli's head, and, you know, a bit of roughhousing, haha, welcome to the Premier League, Mario. And they said the same thing when Diego Costa was sort of reacting to Seamus Coleman. And I'm thinking to myself, ooh, are they really being clever, or are they just kind of being idiots? I'm not going to get into the ethical thing of what Senderos was doing, but yeah, you're trying to wind him up, and then if you get caught, if people see you kicking at him, you get sent off, and it doesn't really help your team at all. Same thing with Diego Costa. It was all a big giggle, but then he did pick up a yellow in that, and that might cost him a suspension at that point. Am I wrong here, Matt? Like, should we just not actually really be praising that, especially when people get caught?
That's a calculated risk, isn't it? If it works and the player gets, if the striker loses their head and gets sent off or whatever, or gets frustrated and starts sulking and disappears, it works. If not, then it can easily backfire. I mean, I'm not a big one for sort of praising the dark arts. Perhaps you'd ask our South American expert. I'm sure he's all over that kind of stuff.
Seamus Coleman and Philippe Senderos, of course, are both South American players raised and schooled in the Paolo Montero school.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Hughes is right. It is a calculated risk. I'm not sure.
It's not something we should be celebrating, though. It's kind of stupid.
I think the thing with that is that it's more that the risk is a calculated risk, but the risk is enormous, because how do you know that the player whose head you're trying to get in inverted commas, isn't going to react by lifting his game? It just seems like I don't quite understand the psychology of it. Are strikers that sort of mentally fragile that they're affected by it? I don't know. I don't know if it works.
I also kind of think that there's massive double standard, because, of course, Marco Materazzi, who supposedly did this all the time, and I have to bring him up occasionally as well. No, he's the devil. He's the disease of football, right? But then when Senderos does it, it's all good.
When were you most recently at Marco Materazzi's house?
What?
When were you most recently at Marco Materazzi's house?
In May.
Yeah, there you go.
And
yeah.
Then I saw him in Rio at the World Cup. But I think it is a valid point. Alison,
how many players in that game was Senderos going to get close to anyway? I mean,
but it doesn't mean that he has to kick the one guy he gets close to all the time.
We're creating this, I think, quite complicated narrative.
He was like in Balotelli's underwear. It was like X-rated.
That's because Balotelli was there.
Yeah, I know, but
so there,
it's not something to praise him for. I think
it's false logic to assume that Senderos had a particular plan for a particular type of player with a particular reputation. It could have been Lambert, and Ricky Lambert, and he might have done the same thing.
Well, let me leave you with this thought on Balotelli. Do you think so? I'm going to try. I know it's very difficult to play pop psychologist, and especially getting into Mario's mind, but the fact that he didn't react, and he didn't go crazy, and he didn't kick out, and he didn't sulk.
But he did sulk, didn't he? I mean, you know, that was the...
No, he didn't sulk.
That was the narrative, I thought, that he looked a bit sulky.
Can I say something? But that's a stupid narrative from the same bunch of...
Just the same, narrative we're buying into by saying that Senderos was practicing dark arts deliberately on a player who has a reputation for getting a bit...
We saw Senderos kick him several times. We saw Senderos rub up against him in a rather dubious way. Right, we saw this happening. He was praised for it on television.
We don't know that Senderos would not have done the same thing to any other striker.
A less handsome striker, you don't think so?
Part of the Villa strategy.
Had that been Diego Costa?
Villa strategy was to look tough and no nonsense and to be feisty throughout.
I was driving at something else.
I know, I'm saying you shouldn't be.
No, I'm saying like the fact that I'm wondering, is this a learning opportunity for Balotelli, where he goes home and says like, oh look, that guy was acting like a fool the entire game. If I met him in a dark alley, I'd turn him into a little puddle of Swiss oil. But I actually kept my cool, and guess what? It's not so bad. All that happened is we lost a football match. So what? All right, enough of this. Let's move on to our debate. We're going to talk Newcastle here. Listeners know we tend to only talk Newcastle when George Culkin is around, for obvious reasons. This time we're going to attempt to understand this situation without the help of George. And I want to start with you, Matt, because obviously you're very close to Alan Pardew. You guys have a lot of things in common. How do you think he's feeling right now?
Excuse me? I don't think anyone really wants anyone up there, really. I did feel sorry for Pardew last season to an extent when he was getting hammered, despite Newcastle being eighth in the Premier League. And they did tail off badly, but, you know, he was judged by their excellent start and the seemingly impossible standards that he has to aspire to. These things, sometimes they reach a point of no return, and for Pardew that could be coming quickly unless they get a couple of wins.
Rory, I'm always struck by how, sort of reading the English media, and I have not spent a lot. I've been to Newcastle. I have not spent a lot of time there. You obviously grew up closer to there than I did.
But I lived in Newcastle for a bit.
You actually lived there. Good. Yeah. Then, well, A, why is it sort of treated almost as like some sort of foreign entity by the national media? It's like a place where the thinking and the logic is just so different from the rest of the country.
Because it is near the soon-to-be independent nation of Scotland.
Okay, but they're not particularly Scottish in outlook, are they?
No, there's a big myth about Newcastle, which is that it's England's great one club city, when everyone knows that that's Leeds, which is a much bigger city than Newcastle and has the same number of football teams. I think the thing with Newcastle
there's
is
there's a lot of Huddersfield fans in Leeds, aren't
there? There are no Huddersfield fans in Leeds at all. There's a lot of Man United fans in Leeds. Very odd. Yeah, Newcastle's kind of far away, basically, from London. That's the thing. It's really far away, Newcastle.
It's far away from the media hub.
Well, no, I think it's the Geordies are, I don't want to be all patronising, but they are slightly separate. Geordies, I'm sure they would say that, as would Scousers. I think that certain motives are ascribed to Newcastle that are maybe not entirely legitimate, and it's assumed that they function in a different way, because it's always been assumed that the club functions in a different way and the fans function in a different way, almost as though it means more in Newcastle for some reason. I don't think that's really true. I think football clubs mean the same amount to everybody, whatever the club is, wherever they are, but they are held to some extent to a different standard. But then at the same time, in recent years, they have kind of behaved slightly weirdly, Newcastle. Well, Newcastle currently, the current regime, do weird things.
Yeah, you know, are they weird? Is there some weirdness that you don't understand, Alison?
There's an owner that doesn't speak, which isn't unusual particularly.
It's not like Roman Abramovich has done many
interviews. No, exactly. It's not completely unusual, but I think it's the juxtaposition of him being, by all accounts, a great guy to go drinking with, a bit of a laugh. He looks really ordinary and accessible, and yet he isn't. And he's quite hard to predict what he'll do next.
Yeah, you kind of
I think he enjoys that. One presumes he does.
You kind of expect it with a Russian billionaire, that he's not going to talk. You don't necessarily expect someone like Mike Ashley, who's a sort of self-made man. Abramovich is a self-made man. It's less surprising that Abramovich doesn't talk than it is that Ashley doesn't talk.
Well, there is the language thing with Abramovich,
yeah, of course,
as well.
Yeah.
It is all these juxtapositions. And, you know, Pardew has himself said that Ashley's a great bloke to go drinking with. He's just not necessarily a great bloke to work for. And I think because we can never second guess, as the media and indeed the fans, second guess what's going to happen next. It does have this sort of strange fascination as a club, as an entity.
Well, is the danger with Newcastle though at the moment not that? So the fans don't like Pardew, that's clear. If you were to look at it kind of objectively, you probably assume that Pardew's reached that stage that a lot of managers reach at a lot of clubs, where things are kind of stopped working a little bit. He's not got that same impact on the players, which happens to most managers in most clubs. It wouldn't be a shock if a couple of defeats down the line, if they sacked him, you'd be hard to say that that's a really bad decision from Ashley. But because no one's quite sure how committed Ashley is to Newcastle, what his intentions are with Rangers, all this stuff, is there not a danger that Newcastle kind of get trapped in a sort of form of stasis where basically Ashley thinks, what's the point of paying up however much of Pardew's contract I've got to pay up when we're not going to get relegated? You know, we will finish mid-table. It probably won't be a great season, but there's far worse teams in the Premier League than Newcastle. Why not just stick with it until I can work out what I want to do with this club? Because that's the big thing with Newcastle. No one's quite sure what Ashley wants to do.
Well, Hughesy, is do you see where Rory's coming from? I mean, is it like a guy who kind of bought a toy and then isn't quite as interested in it anymore, and so he just kind of leaves it lying around on his bedroom floor?
I think Rory's hit upon two things that are important. One is the sort of uncertainty that surrounds the club, and uncertainty in sport is never good. You need a plan, you need to be moving forward. If you're not, you'll go backwards pretty quickly. The other thing is the sort of Newcastle, to an extent, they're almost victims of the nature of the Premier League. They're probably too good and too big to go down, or they did relatively recently, but they're never really going to challenge in the upper echelon. So almost, what's the point of Newcastle? And, you know, as a result of that, the point of Newcastle is sort of civic pride and playing good football and winning a few games, and sort of the intangibles become more important than they really should be. And this sort of gives reason for the fans to make noise and sound off about other things, and they have a go at the manager, they have a go at the board. But when they're kind of, they're a bit of a listless ship, really. And I think no matter who was in charge, that would almost be the case because of the size of the club. Unless they get a really bad manager, they're going to be kind of mid-table, and fans won't have something to moan about.
And it's not just Newcastle. It's a lot of those clubs who are kind of outside of the top three or four, really. That there is this sort of sense that things aren't quite right, so we've got to change. And when we talk about sort of English football short-term focus, we forget that there's a lot of clubs that are kind of disenfranchised from the pursuit of trophies. And someone said to me on Twitter, actually, I think it's quite a good point, that the reason transfer deadline day has become such a big thing is because getting a good signing in is the closest most clubs will come to winning a trophy now. You're not going to win the league unless you're realistically two or three clubs. You know, Arsenal might, but it shouldn't be Chelsea, City or United for the foreseeable future winning the title, really. Chances are you're not going to win a cup, because they're also strong. You're not going to be in Europe. So you kind of resort to whatever glory you can find, and that comes in the transfer market. But I also think it manifests in the sense that you are, when the intangibles are important, as Hughie says, then it's much easier to become dissatisfied with those intangibles, to decide that something's wrong, even though you don't quite know what it is.
I think that they've gone past the joke stage at Newcastle now. They're so used to not winning anything that they don't care anymore. It's about... As Rory was saying, it's about being able to play really nice football and give everyone, when they go to St James's, everyone should feel slightly nervous about going there and playing good football. And the reason the fans are so annoyed at the moment is that the Newcastle started to play some really nice stuff centred around Johan Cabaye, and maybe you shouldn't have just focused on one player, and that was... But to have that pull from under them, and he was sold for no good reason at all, it completely...
Well, you know what? I think we in the media have a duty here to go a little beyond that. You know, and I'm sorry, and I realize there's... God, how can I say this? Okay, I'll take all this back, but I'll say this. There's a reason all those people went to Newcastle in those circumstances. And I think we're being a little bit intellectually dishonest, as Mourinho might say, if we sort of say like, oh, but look, then you sold Johan Cabaye. He had to sell Johan Cabaye. And I think we all know that.
But they were playing, yeah, but what you can see and what you can feel
I agree with that. It's
starting to look like this is a scary place to come, and they had pride in what their team were doing, and they were prepared to overlook the fact Pardew was in charge because he wasn't welcome in the first place. So it's about just absorbing what you get and saying, okay, this isn't so bad. And then it disintegrates quite quickly for whatever the political reasons, and then your manager... I think he's quite statesmanlike when he talks about the owner, but the fans don't like it because he just backs Ashley. He doesn't say, I really need this, I really want that. He just says he's the owner, he does what he wants to do. And they just feel trapped in a soap opera that's not what they want. And if anyone wants to know what they do want, I suggest they read Far Corner by Harry Pearson, which brings that corner of the country to life.
Or better yet, read anything by George Calkin, who, in addition to being far more handsome than Harry Pearson, is also one of our friends and colleagues.
He is very handsome, isn't he, George?
But certainly more so than Harry Pearson.
I don't know what Harry Pearson looks like, but...
Do you know what he looks like?
He's a perfectly decent bloke, yeah.
Relative to George?
Well, no one's...
Exactly.
Compared to George.
How about some quick hits? Hang on. Let me get my little sound box here so that we can keep everybody disciplined, because, of course, stringent adherence to discipline is the way to enlightenment, as... Hughie and I know all too well. 20-second answers. At 20 seconds, you will hear this. And at 25 seconds, you will hear this, and you will stop talking. For some reason, they've been dubbed the Galacticos with two A's, which I think is absolutely demented and completely unimaginative, and shame on the people who keep fueling this. But, Allison, United were, in fact, pretty darn good on Sunday, weren't they? Or should we just slow down the bandwagon, given that it was only QPR they were playing? QPR, which, by the way, Falcao, when he tweeted them, he said, I'm excited to play Queen's Park Rogers. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, well, there's so much to say, so little time. very glad Van Gaal started to get personal talking about his wife. I mean, what sort of presents is he going to give her every weekend? I mean, it's all right once on her birthday, but I mean, she's going to presumably need presents at least twice a week or to keep it going. What everyone's looking at?
Is presents a euphemism?
No. Well, actually, Van Gaal did make it sound like it was a euphemism. It was only QPR. I predicted 4-2, and I think that's the sort of season it's going to be. They're gonna lose 5-3 and win 4-2 a lot.
There was so much to say, and yet you spent most of it talking about Van Gaal's wife. But Van Gaal, I think, was very he was correct when he said, "Look, you know, this is one game, long journey. I really didn't have time to work with these people." Basically saying QPR were rubbish. Now he cannot stop scoring. Diego Costa is up to 7 goals in his first 4 Premier League games, and he's eclipsed the legendary Mickey Quinn's record. Bet nobody knew that Mickey Quinn had the record there. Matt, please find new ways to praise him.
Well, as a disclaimer, I've not actually seen him play yet this season, unfortunately, due to various fixture quirks, but he's been fantastic. The most impressive thing is his intelligence, really, his positional sense. He's great. He always seems to be in the right area. He's got an almost telepathic relationship with Cesc Fabregas. And if Chelsea keep serving him in the way they are, they're going to go very close to winning the Premier League.
Spurs leave 2 points at the Stadium of Light as Sunderland's late equaliser makes it 2-2. Still, glass half full for your Spanish-speaking mate Pochettino, Rory?
An improvement on the performance today. It's Liverpool slightly unlucky to concede the late equaliser, the Harry Kane own goal. I think for all of those teams in the pack behind Chelsea, there's good things and bad things, but the most important thing is that they are all waiting for each other. So no one's had a particularly convincing start. Arsenal have drawn 3 games. So Spurs are still in the hunt for a Champions League place, obviously, as it's very early on, and no one else is clearing away from them.
Everton needed to keep a clean sheet, and they did just that, winning 2-0 at West Brom. Alison, is this normal service resuming? Stingy back line and all that?
I think it probably helped to have a mix of youth and experience at the back, because it was Stones and Jagielka this time. And I think the problem might be that Distan and Jagielka together sometimes look a bit overrun. But on paper, the way it was set up, and I love Coleman and Baines. I think there's a lot to build on there for Everton. Maybe adding Stones at the back is the thing to do.
I love Distan myself. Roy Hodgson may have been a bit grumpy after the Norway game, but he was vindicated with that Switzerland result and performance, right, Matt? Ollie Kay, I think, tweeted out something like, "There's not much you can say when every single England player plays extremely well." So does that mean that you negative Nellies now will get off his back and just let him do his job?
Well, we'll be off his back if he keeps supervising impressive performances like the one in Switzerland last week. Unfortunately, there's going to be not much to write about for the next 2 years because they've got a cakewalk to France. But they were good. I like the system. I like the way Sterling is at the centre of it. Wilshere has work to do to nail down the holding role. But we're certainly in a better place than we were in Rio a couple of months ago.
Well, it doesn't take too much. 1 point from 3 games. Southampton pummel Newcastle 4-0, and Graziano Pelle scores 2. Rory, is he the best Italian centre forward in the Premier League? Is there a broader lesson here about perhaps buying players from Holland?
Graziano Pelle is probably not the best Italian centre forward in the Premier League, because that, I would imagine, is Mario Balotelli. He is a very good centre forward, but no, I don't think there's a broader lesson here about buying players from Holland. The Dutch league has some strengths, but broadly its big weakness is that defenders in it are terrible. So that it's very easy to score goals. It depends on the player who you get from Holland. Pelé's done well. Tadic looks all right as well. Probably better than all right. There are good players there, but it's not somewhere that you should go and import loads from.
Somebody tweeted me last night and said that Graziano Pelle was 6'4", Italian, and gorgeous. And I thought, wow, he's just like me. We're exactly the same.
Gab,
and it was a dude, yes. It probably was a dude, actually. It's hard to tell.
Gab, one for you. We had a replay of the Champions League final on Saturday night. Was it the same result as back in May?
No, we didn't, actually, because Atletico Madrid this time won the game. It was a remarkable match. Real Madrid in the first half, I thought, looking really, really good. Could have scored 3, but Moya was phenomenal in goal. But the usual bugbears, set pieces, no holding midfielders, ending up hurting Carlo Ancelotti's men. I have a lot of praise for Diego Simeone in the paper on Monday. So please read it and enjoy it. What's that? I get different sound effects, of course.
Because I can't work out which buttons you use. Which ones do you use?
Ray gun and lightning.
Right. I went for punch and guitar solo.
Oh, this is Alison's favourite part of the show. Any other business?
I just wanted to say, because I was at Selhurst Park, and everyone says it now, but the fans are just phenomenal. And I spoke to Kevin Day, who put a really nice piece together for Match of the Day 2 with a Back to the Future theme, which I think worked really well. And he's a big Palace fan. And he said for balance, he had to try and find some annoyed or disgruntled Palace fans. The way it's all unfolded this summer, it was pretty despairing. But they said they're all so lovely and optimistic, and they won't say a word against anybody there. And the joy of going there, it was 0-0, and it wasn't great quality, and yet it's still a nice place to go. Regardless of what's happening there, the fans are proper fans.
I haven't had any other business. It's really quick. We think about offside wrong. Really annoys me.
What do you mean?
All this talk of, if someone's like leg is offside, they are not offside. I don't understand why FIFA have fannied about with the rules so much, but it irritates me every game I go to, every game I watch. You are offside. It was introduced to stop people goal-hanging. You're not offside if you're a centimetre offside. That's not a legitimate decision. I don't know why they got rid of daylight. I think that was a perfectly good rule. But the way it is constructed now, it affects attacking moves more than it's meant to. And it's changed the nature of how we play the game, and I think it needs to be examined.
Well, this might be something we can debate in the future. Many thanks to my guest today, Alison Rudd, Rory K. Smith, and taking time out from his busy, busy traveling schedule in Germany. We always appreciate it. It's Mr. Matt Hughes. Check out thetimes.co.uk. If you're a member, you get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of your subscription. If you're not a member, take our £1 digital trial today. Just search Times Sport online. See you same place, same time next week. Till then, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story. The Times daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.